This edition of The Stack was first broadcast on the 12th of January 2013 on Monocle 24.
An Australian editor with an eye for detail, a journalism veteran on what makes magazines work and what doesn't, and one of the world's top photojournalists on working in war zones. All that, plus much more, on Edition 20 of The Stack with me, Andrew Tuck. Also coming up, we head to Berlin to speak to Offscreen magazine, a publication focusing on the people behind the pixels in the world of graphic design.
It's about people that work behind the scene, and it's about their lives and what goes on in their heads, what makes them tick and what makes them do things the way they've done it.
We'll also hear from one designer on his secret recipe for a successful magazine.
For me, what makes for good magazine design is mostly the appropriateness of that design to the content, to the audience, and to the means of distribution.
All that and a few more reading tips too, live from Studio One at Midori House in London. Hello and welcome to Edition 20 of The Stack. Each Saturday, we sit down with editors and photographers, correspondents and creative directors to review the best in established weeklies and obscure journals, big city dailies and one-off personal projects, and keep an eye on the forces shaping the industry. Normally, it's Tyler Brulé in this hot seat, but as he's on the road in Asia, you've got me. But rest assured, he'll be running proceedings next week. Anyway, we've lots to come in the next hour, so let's meet our guests. Our two guest magazine reviewers are sitting here eagerly, ready to work through a stack of magazines. The first is Monocle regular John Owen. John chairs the Frontline Club Forum, is a professor of international journalism at City University in London, and is an international media consultant and co-editor of International News Reporting. Welcome to Midori House, John. As I said, you're a regular here. That's quite a lot of titles to get on a card.
Well, I think it's what they all add up to.
Okay. And what does that add up to you? What's your week like? What are you doing on most weeks?
Well, it depends on the time of year. Right now, I'm having a very nice break because City University is on a midterm break, and I'm not traveling anywhere, at least not anywhere for work reasons. I've just come back from California with my son and daughter, and had a good chance to roam around California and about to go to Toronto. And so it's a nice time of year.
And how did you get your chair in academia? Did you start out as a cub reporter, or did you work your way up actually through the world of academia?
I'm a pseudo-academic, I think a lot of my friends would say, because my whole life, most of my life, has been in working journalism. I'm a Hoosier. I was born in Indiana, migrated to Canada, and thought I'd be there a year, and ended up spending about 20 years. And my major career was with the CBC, which I went from being a kind of on-the-desk guy to running CBC News.
And so we used to see you on screen, did we, as well?
No. I have a face made for radio, as they said. So, no.
And the move into academia was because you felt that you had had enough, or you because you wanted to kind of pass on the knowledge you had? What lured you to cross over the road?
Well, I'm not, I mean, as I said, I'm not a pure academic. I mean, although I've taught City 10 years and I've been lecturing at various places, I just love thinking.
It's quite nice being a professor.
Well, it's just wonderful kind of thinking about journalism and then staying engaged in journalism so you have something to say to somebody. I don't really think people who are out of journalism should be teaching it. I think that's a big mistake in journalism education. But at City, what's really great, and like in all of these places, is the students. I mean, I have 100 students from 32 countries who are all engaged in journalism of some kind. So I'm really learning from them. I mean, they're just really fascinating people.
And we're going to be looking through some magazines from around the world later on. But just tell me, when you are teaching people from so many different countries, and again, we'll touch on this with our next guest, are you sometimes concerned that they're going back to countries where it's actually been going to be quite difficult for them to use their craft and skill in the way that they're practicing it while they're in the classroom in London?
Well, that's one of the primary things we talk about, and what they can do in terms of survival skills. But a lot of it has to do with And these are universal considerations, ethical issues. You know, what do you do? How do you overcome self-censorship, which is a huge issue in these countries, not only waiting for the call telling you what you can publish and not publish or put on air, but figuring out what to do when you know what you should be doing, but you're not doing it because you're afraid of the call. And that's a big challenge. Also, just learning how to stay alive and how to take risk and how to deal with everything related to trauma in many of these countries. That's what a lot of local journalists have to put up with. What they see, what they experience is far different from even the best of the kind of combat journalists.
Well, my next guest is certainly a woman who has got used to navigating those risks in quite an extraordinary way, because joining us is Lindsay Addario. Lindsay is an American photojournalist based here in London, but her work takes her all over the world, and in fact, to some of the world's most hostile environments. She's covered conflicts in Afghanistan, Iraq, Lebanon, Darfur, and Congo, and she shoots features across the Middle East, South Africa, and Asia. Welcome, Lindsay. That's a roll call of many, many countries. Anybody who's interested in your work, and I'm sure everyone will be, they should just go to your website and to see the range of material. My first instinct when I looked at it was it's interesting work because it's along a borderline that could almost be art and photojournalism. If I saw one of these pictures blown up massive in a gallery, I would stop and stare, and you know, I may want to purchase it. But in the right context, it's telling a news story. But it's not perhaps the most snapped imagery in a sense. There's some contemplation often, it seems, behind your images. Is that fair?
I try to do that. I think one of the biggest challenges I have as a photographer who covers conflict is trying to bring a new perspective to the same images that we've seen of war over the decades. I've recently been asked to write something on Vietnam, and I was going back and looking at all these books on Vietnam by Larry Burroughs, Don McCullen, all the great Vietnam photographers. And it was so startling because all of these images look like images that we are taking now in Afghanistan with just different ethnicity, different faces. And it's the same series of images over and over. And so one of the biggest challenges I have as a photographer is trying to bring something new and trying to make an image that will stop people and arrest them and make them look and think about what they're looking at. Because so often people just see an image and they turn the page because they say, oh, I can't look at another person dying or another civilian freezing in a refugee camp. And so how do you do that differently, or how do you do that in a way that's compelling?
Lindsay, I think both me and John are looking forward to unpicking that a little bit and talking to you about that in depth. But first of all, how did you start as in your career? Were you once a student sitting in a class like John's thinking, I want to be a journalist, or did you just pick up the camera and go?
I just picked up the camera and went. I never studied photography. I never actually realized that photojournalism was a career because I grew up in a household with hairdressers as parents. And
you've got good hair.
I'm joking. I have horrible hair.
John's pointing out he has no hair, so it's fine. We press on.
Well, more often than not, I'm wearing a headscarf, so it doesn't really matter. So I really, in our household growing up, there was never that discussion of what are you going to do when you're older or what will you study. It was more or less everything was wide open. And so I was always interested in photography, and I photographed, but I assumed it was a hobby. And eventually, after university, where I studied international relations, all I wanted to do was photograph. So I moved to Argentina to study Spanish, and I started photographing there while I was learning Spanish. And I went into the local newspaper, the English newspaper, and said, I want a job. And they sort of looked at me and laughed and said, you have no experience, get out of here. And I basically went back every single week until they got so sick of me that they just gave me fake assignments. And every day I would come back with a new picture, whatever they asked for. And eventually they just started giving me work. And that's how I started.
And Lindsay, just tell me finally, what was the first mission that you were given or you gave yourself that fell under that loose brand war reporting or conflict reporting? Where was the toughest? The first time you thought, do you know what? My adrenaline's flowing. This is it.
Well, it's funny because in retrospect, I would say I went to Afghanistan under the Taliban when I was 26 years old, and I sort of just saved my money and went to photograph women living under the Taliban. And at that time, it was very difficult to get a visa for Afghanistan, and photography was illegal when the Taliban was in power. And I didn't think anything of it. I sort of went there and said, oh, I want to photograph women. And now I realize, wow, that was pretty dangerous. And you know, that was probably the first assignment where I did something in a war zone or in a place that could constitute war reporting. But I would say the first time that I really covered conflict was the fall of the Taliban in Kandahar. And the first time I was in a gun battle was in Iraq in 2003. And that was the first time where my adrenaline was really flowing, and I just said, I want to go home. I don't think I can do this.
Well, I look forward to speaking to you more about that. There's so many things that have already been raised, and we've already done the introductions. Lindsay and John, thank you very much for joining us, and you're going to be staying with us over the next hour because you're listening to The Stack on Monocle 24. When you first pick up a new magazine, before you read even a page, you probably have a good idea of what it's about, based on how it's designed. Everything from the typeface to the layout should speak of the content and the intended audience. So, what makes a good magazine design? Stuart Geddes is one half of Chase & Galley, a specialist magazine and publication design firm based in Melbourne, Australia. He's been involved in designing or redesigning some interesting independent publications, such as the avant-garde interview magazine Dumbo Feather, the literary journal Mian Jin, and also the historic Architecture Australia magazine, as well as books on design and architecture. He's also a motorcycle enthusiast, so his latest project is a zine called Head Full of Snakes, and it's all about that very topic. Monocle's Artie Bettigeri spoke to him in his studio in inner Melbourne.
Well, I'm looking at a copy of it now, the launch issue, and it's fantastically old school. It's like my high school yearbook in terms of the paper stock and the fonts and even the photographs inside. How did you come to this?
I guess the design for it partly comes from old motorcycle magazines, for sure. It also kind of mashes that together with quite contemporary graphic design ideas and idiosyncrasies, I guess.
What is it, in your opinion, that makes for good magazine design?
For me, what makes for good magazine design is mostly the appropriateness of that design to the content, to the audience, and to the means of distribution. To go for an easy picking is, you'd have to say Bloomberg Businessweek is you know, a fantastic example of recent magazine design because it's so clearly a business magazine, but it's so intelligently done. The way it displays information is so clear. The way they're doing the covers has like a really engaging sort of advertising for business feel to it. It just feels incredibly uniquely what it is and very direct.
So how many seconds should it take you when you first look at a magazine cover to work out what it's about, based not on the cover lines or the name of it, but on purely the design? Is that a factor?
I think that depends entirely on the magazine. If it's important for it to be direct, then absolutely. I don't know how many seconds, but another kind of magazine, it suits for that to be a slower burn and to be more curious and engaging and sort of draw you in over a longer period. So in that sense, again, it's always back to appropriateness. I guess, you know, again, from my experience, the working on Dumbo Feather was such a, its focus being on these long form interviews was such a pleasure because you could really take your time with them. And we developed this idiosyncratic typesetting system, which really reflected the rhythm of an interview. So I guess technically there are a few things that facilitate how the typesetting mirrors the flow of a conversation. Things that we did, like essentially overlapping two sets of columns, one for text and one for answer, so the answers actually kind of indent and push into the answers, but in a way that's very clear navigationally where something starts and something ends.
Like the way people might interrupt each other in a conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. That kind of thing is very clear on the page. The questions have like the questions answers have quite different type styles. The questions are a centered sans serif and the answers are a left aligned serif. And there was this lovely kind of innovation that we kept from the previous designer, which was having pull quotes in the middle of the paragraph, like in the place where they are, which I always had this thing where I kind of feel slightly ripped off by pull quotes when I read them and then I read them again in the paragraph. It's always a sort of jarring moment. So breaking mid-sentence into what's essentially compositionally on the page of a pull quote is becomes a quite natural thing and adds to these quite beautiful pages. And I guess like what all of that does is when it becomes very clear visually on the page that when you have short questions and short answers, you get like you get this quite rapid fire thing going down the page. Whereas when you get a short question that leads to a really long answer, the question is just sort of sitting there in the top left corner, anchoring this large expanse of text. And then also it becomes very obvious when the interviewer is asking, larger questions than the answers that they're getting.
Well, that was our report from Melbourne with Stuart Geddes of Chase and Galley, who was speaking to Monocle's Artie Bettigeri. Lindsay, can I just quickly ask you a question? In the old days when I used to work on news magazines, photographers would send in their pictures with very strict rules. This must not be cropped. This must not this. This must not. But these days, I wonder if those rules stick anymore. How much concern do you have when the photograph leaves you, goes to a magazine, and do you like to see the layout before it goes to print? Are you concerned about how the pictures are laid out?
Of course, but I think the publications that I work for are Time, New York Times, National Geographic. Those are publications that won't take your photo and chop it in half or do something really dramatic without checking with you first. I think that depending on the reputation of the publication, you know that if you have to be worried. Those publications, I do not. I am not, I guess, a total purist. I don't mind if sometimes I crop a bit of my images. I don't always frame perfectly in camera. So I think sometimes I do have to crop a little bit. But I do, any photo editor, any designer will go over that before they crop it.
John, I think you've got something to comment on that.
Well, I was going to ask you, Lindsay, though, but also today you have a lot more freedom beyond the publication of your photograph, don't you? I mean, if you're not satisfied, then website and so many other places where you can do what you want to do.
Absolutely. In fact, sometimes if a publication publishes an image selection that I'm not happy with, or if they publish images in a way that I just don't agree with, I will go and invest my own money and, for example, have a multimedia piece made or put up a slideshow. Or luckily I have Seven, the agency I work with, and they'll put up a slideshow and a selection of images.
So photo editors, watch out, because Lindsay, she'll be there. She'll be waiting and watching. And John, just before we quickly move on, I know that obviously at City you have people looking at the design of paper print, of magazines and newspapers. Do you sometimes worry that younger designers get a bit carried away with kind of the craziest of kind of fonts and graphic design that in a way sometimes stops the story being told when, you just need to get some eloquent words on print?
Well, actually, it's reverse. I mean, I think most of the students that I've been exposed to are more interested in the story. They're more interested in going to get the images. A distinct minority are really that drawn to sort of the design of the publications. They're really interested in going into the field and being Lindsay.
Brilliant. Well, there's going to be lots more discussion. I can see they're both kind of dying to jump back in, but I have to have a word as well in this show, because you're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. And stay with us, because after the break, we're going to be working through that stack of magazines.
Before you set off on your travels this winter season, don't forget to pick up your issue of Monocle's winter newspaper, Monocle Alpino. We get cold weather combat training from Japan's elite snow patrols. We look at how Iceland has picked itself up and dusted itself off after a nasty wipeout. And we find the comfortable alpine retreats that will have you packing your bags and heading for the hills. Plus, we look at winter warming fashion ideas with all of the trimmings, including Bavarian lederhosen. That's all in the current issue of Monocle Alpino. Prost und zum Wohl!
If you're on the go but still want to stay tuned in to Monocle 24, then download the Monocle mobile phone app. You'll have access to our live stream, past shows, Monocle's daily web column, and our 2525 city guides. And it's available for iPhone, Windows Phone 7, and Nokia N9 devices. So take Monocle 24 with you wherever you are, whether you're beachside or airborne. Head to monocle.com for more details.
You're listening to The Stack with me, Andrew Tuck. Now, we're going to start looking through the magazines that both John and Lindsay have brought in. And John, would you like to pick something that perhaps you've brought in first? I think you've raided your archive as well as bringing a few fresh things off the newsstand.
Well, I brought some things with me physically, and then I brought my iPad because I am drawn to several of the magazines I subscribe to, and I think they do hold up very well digitally, others do not. So I love The New Yorker. The New Yorker is, I can't wait for it to be published. And because of erratic postal delivery, I love it, you know, digitally. And it looks the same as the magazine. And so I love the way it looks. And I can't wait to see, we were just talking about this, Lindsay, and I can't wait to get John Lee Anderson's reporting or Jane Mayer, whatever it is. So that magazine does work for me digitally as well as in text. And I'd love to have it in front of me and walk around and have it, but I'm satisfied. On the other hand, I used to subscribe digitally to the New York Review of Books, which, you know, for all of your design people, it's not the world's most interesting looking magazine. It's looked like this forever. But I went back to subscribing to it because it is much more satisfying in print. And I wasn't reading it digitally. So now I love it, having it back. And in every magazine, there is a real long series of reviews of books about something. In this particular new issue, it's on Saudi Arabia.
Now, can I ask you, John, the New Yorker hints at something which I always think is an interesting dichotomy in U.S. media. How can you have, 20,000 words being printed there, people sitting down reading them, but you also have the same people probably stuck in front of a TV, which is everything is like 5 seconds long? It's interesting, isn't it? Because I don't think British magazines or many European magazines would be able to offer their readers again and again 20,000 words, 30,000 words on a topic, and people read them voraciously. There's something quite interesting in the US media. There are these pockets of really demanding, highly intelligent, smartly written, longer form reporting that people will sit down and read.
You know what I think the explanation of that is that newspapers here are flourishing, and you have the kind of long form writing in the amazing selection of newspapers here, whether it's the Times, the Telegraph, Guardian, whatever. You don't have that many choices in newspapers. So I think the fact that where you get real choice is in print, is in magazine writing in the United States, while here, for the most part, you get it in newspapers. And the magazines, frankly, I don't find that appealing.
And you've got a copy of Newsweek in front of you, and it was one we picked up actually on The Stack last week. It's interesting, I would imagine, for a whole generation of people, that was where you went to in the US for news. It's summed up something about telling stories. It felt, essential. And it kind of lost its way. For you, what do you feel when you look at that very final issue now of Newsweek?
Well, I look at it as a photographer, of course, because I'm in an industry where there are fewer and fewer places to send my work. So if I shoot a photo essay and it's not commissioned and I want to try and get it published, there are very few publications where I can actually call or email now and say, hey, do you have space for this? And it was always Time, Newsweek, New York Times. There are more venues online, of course, but I still like to see my images in print. I think it's something old-fashioned, but I still do like to see that. And so, I brought in this issue because I was slated to have a story in this issue, and about an hour before it closed, the shooting in Newtown happened in Connecticut, and it was pushed out. And it was interesting because it was pushed out, but it would never see the light of day because, of course, it was the last issue. And so it just speaks so much to the time we're in right now in journalism. you know, publications are closing and they're going online exclusively.
Now, you hinted at something at the top of the show, which I think is really worth talking about. I used to work for a newsprint magazine here for the independent newspapers. And it was an interesting time even then. We're talking about 8-9 years ago, where, you know, the people would offer you stories that you knew were important, that were tough, that were slightly brutal, but you also knew that nobody would read them. Now, what was terrifying was that you would have somebody say, I've been spending, you know, 3 months in this refugee camp. It's, you know, the conditions are terrible. Children are dying. And you'd look at the pictures, and unfortunately, you had seen them all before. They didn't tell you anything different. They could have been any refugee camp. And you felt heartless. You felt heartless saying to these people, I know you've spent 3 months there, but I don't think anyone will ever read this. And I wonder for you, how difficult is it coming back from a mission where you think, do you know what, I've just seen some of the worst things ever, and you go to some snotty, you know, editor like me sitting in behind a night's desk, and he says, you know, nothing I can do with that. Do you understand both sides of that relationship, or do you walk out that office, you know, kicking the door and getting in the lift and determined to kind of punch him in the face when you see him next?
Yeah, I mean, I would say there is probably no phrase on the planet that annoys me more than we've seen it before, because we've seen everything before. There is nothing we haven't seen before, pretty much. Everything's been photographed. So if someone says that to you, then what are we doing? What are any of us doing? What are we doing as journalists? What are we doing as photographers? And I think, you know, the challenge is trying to make a story that we've seen before compelling. How do you personalize it? How do you make it more intimate? How do you bring a new perspective to it? How do you take refugees in Sudan or in Darfur or in Congo? Look at the conflict in Congo. I mean, we've seen how many, 7 million people have died, I think. It's been going on over 10 years. How do we look at Congo in a new way? You know, people roll their eyes when they see, oh, the rebels have taken Goma. I mean, it's, you know, but we have a responsibility to be there, and we have a responsibility to cover it, because so long as people are dying, we should be there as journalists. And so how do you do it? I don't have the answer to that. I think that it's in a way that is not too bloody, not in a way that's going to make the reader turn the page very quickly. In a way that will pull a person in rather than deter them.
I'll just pick one image that I saw on your site today. There was it was to do with the Afghanistan women series. Now, there was an image that was compelling, that would draw you in and that any editor would take. Now, the interesting thing was you didn't shoot it in black and white. You shot it in extraordinary colour. The use of colour was very interesting. And I think that often many people fall into a language of telling these stories with photography. There are the same kinds of camera shot, the same kind of grit, or the same kind of use of black and white. Are you aware of that when you're shooting it? Are you thinking, you know, this is terrifying, but it's oddly beautiful? You know, that because I think that's the mystery of your pictures for me, is you think, God, this is terrifying, but it's compelling.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are a lot of tricks that you can do as a photographer and as a photojournalist to make your pictures look really dramatic. I mean, there's the whole Dana School of Photoshop, which is very black and white, very contrasty, and they're amazing. I mean, the pictures look really cool and they're beautiful, and of course people are going to look at them. But for me, I'm a pretty straight photographer. I shoot color almost all the time, and the pictures are, you know, I try and tell a story, and I try and make it beautiful, if you can make war beautiful, or I try to make it aesthetically pleasing, so it's not an image that's going to be revolting, even if it's a difficult situation to stomach. But I think that my images are pretty straight. There's not a lot of tilted camera or a lot of Photoshop work on them.
John, how does your gut feel when you hear that kind of conversation and when you hear those decisions made not to run important stories?
Well, I mean, again, it's easy to be the critic outside, and it's different when you're sitting inside the building and your own publisher boss or whoever it is saying, you know, circulation figures are down, this magazine's future is in jeopardy. We have to do this for the following reasons.
Let's take Madonna on the cover.
Yeah, Michael Jackson 24/7, whatever it is. But thank goodness we still have enough publications around and broadcasters around who are committed to doing these things. They're a diminishing number. But as long as there are alternatives, and again, we have all these amazing developments online, which don't put a lot of money into a lot of people's pockets, but at least they're also thriving in many places. So I'm not completely discouraged, but I take Lindsay's point about it must be so infuriating to hear we've seen this all before, when in fact these stories are always, there's always a new story to be told.
Okay, I'm a fledgling foreign correspondent. I'm going to Congo for the first time. I'm going to be reporting on refugees being displaced. What would be your one or two things that you would tell me to think about if I want to sell that story when I come home?
Well, again, the story, it's the devil is in the detail. So, I mean, just abstractly, it sounds like a pretty familiar story. But if you trust your journalist, and again, Lindsay or John Lee Anderson or Haith Abdul-Ahad can go to these places and find the characters, can find the family, can find the unusual tale. And that's why frontline journalism is everything. You can't really understand all this sitting in an office. And the worst thing that would be happening is a failure to commit to people going into the field, or in some cases, supporting freelancers if you don't have staffers. They have to be there. So I wouldn't answer that question. I would believe in the person. I would say, look, I believe that you have the ability to see things that others don't see, to hear things that others don't hear, and to also be present in places other people aren't going. I trust you. I'd be more worried about, what are you doing to look after yourself? Are you properly protected? Here's our channel of communication, because you're going to see terrible things. And when you get back, let's make sure that we're working through what you've seen and experienced. I would trust the person. That I wouldn't be investing in the person, or I wouldn't be supporting the person if I didn't believe they were up to it.
Lindsay, can I ask you, when you're in Darfur or when you're in Afghanistan, I often wonder how much you leave behind of yourself. You know, that when you meet a woman who, you know, you're leaving the village and you realize that her life is kind of done, or you're in Darfur and you think, I wonder, you know, I just wonder what's going to happen when I put my camera in the bag and I get on the plane and I go home. Do you leave a bit of yourself behind?
All the time. I often leave assignments like a basket case. I get very involved with the people I photograph emotionally. And so if I spend a week with a woman who has just set herself on fire, for example, because she's trying to commit suicide because her husband beats her every day, and I spend a week with that woman, and then I pack up my cameras and go home, and I go home to Notting Hill, and I'm very lucky because I have my Nespresso machine and I have my coffee and my freedom, and I go for a run. And that woman's still sitting in the hospital, and she'll probably get killed by her family when she goes home because she had tried to kill herself. That's a really hard thing to stomach, you know, but I can't have any self-pity because I'm the one who's privileged in this situation. So, you know, every single person I photograph takes a little bit out of me and away from me, but it also helps me and makes me stronger because it makes me realize just how lucky I am.
Lindsay and John, we're going to continue this conversation in a little while. But for our listeners, you're listening to The Stack, and stay with us.
The Entrepreneurs is about the movers and shakers, the lone rangers, the innovators, the modern mercantile mavericks, and the venerable merchandisers. It's Monocle 24's weekly business show. Every week, we seek out the startups, the brands on the make, and the leaders of global business empires doing things differently.
Assume you don't know the answer. If you assume that, you have to start creating options for yourself.
From master cobblers to asset managers, from impresarios in the luxury yacht sector to tech startups shaking up Silicon Valley. Tune in on Wednesdays at 1900 hours London time, or download the show on Monocle 24's website.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
Offscreen is a relatively new magazine about the people behind Bits and Pixels. Who are they? What do they do? And what makes them tick? Is published and edited by Kai Brack, a web designer himself. He launched the magazine at the beginning of the year from Melbourne using a German printer because of the superior paper quality, you see. Monocle's Nikki Ertz caught up with Kai in Berlin.
Offscreen is a magazine that explores the life and the work of digital creators, telling the less obvious human story that go on behind the scene of apps and websites and other digital products. So the core of the magazine consists of 8 lengthy interviews with founders, designers, and developers of those websites and apps. And we asked them questions such as, you know, what inspires you? What made you start the company, or what made you design this app? But we also asked quite practical questions such as, how do you manage your team? What inspired you to actually make this decision here and there? Mm-hmm. So the magazine is about people creating digital stuff, but it's also by people working in that industry. Mm-hmm. So the content comes from them as well.
So, but it is about the people. I mean, that's obvious when you open the magazine as well, yeah. That it's only people in there.
That's right. It's only people, and there's no screenshots. There's no tutorials or anything technical. I mean, as the name says, off-screen, it's all about what happens off the screen. It's all about what happens outside of this digital environment that we are constantly in nowadays. And so it's about people that work behind the scene, and it's about their lives and what goes on in their heads, what makes them tick and what makes them do things the way they've done it. Yeah.
And what made you come up with the idea? I mean, who would be interested in whatever these people behind the screens have to say?
There's a bit of a story about the making of a magazine. So I'm a web designer by trade as well. So I've been freelancing as a web designer for almost 12 years before I started the magazine last year. And at some point I realized that I felt quite disconnected from my work, and everything I produced in the digital world, everything you produce lasts as long as the next release cycle. So you produce something, it's out there, and then a week later it's probably gone, or it's, you know, as a designer, it's probably, it doesn't look as nice as you want it to look. So after 10 years or so, I was getting quite tired of my clients and my work, and I was feeling quite burned out, and I decided to take a break. I took a 6-month sabbatical and went traveling for a bit. And that gave me the opportunity to actually meet some of these people that I know through all these social networks.
Yeah, because it was your world.
Right, that's where you live, and you spend 10 hours a day communicating with people that you've actually never seen in person. So I met a lot of people, and I also really enjoyed magazines the whole time. I always use magazines as a way of getting away from the screen and take a break. And at some point I realized, why shouldn't I go the exact opposite direction of everyone else and go from digital to print and put all these stories into a print magazine to enjoy them as a break as well.
Yeah, from digital to print about digital.
That's right. Yeah, going the opposite, but talking about the digital stuff. Mm. Yeah.
It's not a comment on the digital world, on the world of screens.
I guess indirectly it is. Yes, we do spend a lot of time online, and we do spend a lot of time on in front of screens. But at the same time, I think the magazine is just giving the average person a bit of insight into the creativity and the hard work that goes into things like a simple iPhone app or a website. So in a way, it's a celebration of digital, but it's also a celebration of getting away from digital.
What is your favorite part in the magazine? What is your favorite interview or section?
In the process of making it, I think the favorite part is usually the interviews, because I actually get to interview them and ask them questions. And
You do it yourself. Yeah. It's a kind of a one-man magazine.
That's right. So a lot of people ask me, what do you guys do with this? Or how do you guys organize that? And it's usually just one person. I do have a few people helping me with editing and proofreading. And I've got a few people helping me with finding contributors and taking the photos, obviously, because I don't travel around the world. But I do pretty much everything from finding the contributors and the interviewees to interviewing them, and also putting it all together, designing it, and publishing and marketing it, basically.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a lot of work, and I think the funny part about off-screen is that I really want people to get away from the screen, but as a result, I actually spend about 10 hours a day on the screen to actually make it happen.
That was Kai Brack talking to our Berlin correspondent, Nikki Ertz. Offscreen is available in good independent shops and bookstores around the globe. And you're listening to The Stack with me, Andrew Tuck. No, don't worry, Tyler Brûlé is going to be back next week. My two guests this week are John Owen. John chairs the Frontline Club Forum, and he's a professor of international journalism at City University here in London. And I'm also joined by Lindsay Addario. Lindsay is an American photojournalist based here in London, but her work takes her all over the world. And if you go to her website, you'll see extraordinary images that she's shot in Afghanistan, Iraq, Lebanon, Darfur and Congo. We were talking before about the job that you do and the places you go. Lindsay, just quickly before we return to John, I've got so many magazines here, Prospect, Bloomberg, Business Week, you know, The Economist, Forbes, no photography in them. You were talking about the kind of the lamentable state of that. Now, I guess one of the things, one of the best things actually about being at Monocle is, you know, we do put money into sending photographers out. But, you know, many magazines these days, they just go to a photography bank, and even if they're telling a contemporary story about Congo, they feel there's no need to send anyone. They're worried about the insurance and the costs and things.
Yeah.
Do you think that is a proper crisis that we're facing here in how we gather imagery?
Proper crisis. Well, I have to say I'm glad I'm not 21 years old and starting out now, because I think it would be really difficult to start in an industry where magazines in print are fading. I mean, there just aren't as many. I was lucky to start when there was a huge budget to send photographers into the field, and I would get sent on assignment for 2-3 months at a time. Now I'm lucky if I get 5 days. The only publication that really still sends photographers for a long period of time is National Geographic, and they still really invest in assignment photography. And that is rare. There are very few publications. So is it a crisis? I guess it's a crisis. I mean, there are more venues online. A photographer definitely has more freedom to put up his or her own work online and have it seen by many people. That's something that wasn't available 2 decades ago. I think it really depends on what your goal is as a photographer, what you want to do, and who you want to see it.
First of all, it's going to be a bit of depressing news for my 22-year-old daughter who's trying to make it in photography in New
Sorry.
York. I'm going to have to tell her that one of the best photojournalists said she's wasting her time.
I didn't say that.
No. So, how do you reconcile with this incredible exponential growth in the interest in photography and photojournalism with this kind of portrayal of the industry that you've just given us? Because I've never seen so much interest in photography, and you know all the journalism students, all of them are learning to shoot and going places and are very proud of what they're trying to do. It seems to be a complete conundrum.
Yeah, I mean, I've sort of always lived with the philosophy that you have to follow your dreams and do what you're passionate about. So if you really believe in photography, you have to do it, and you have to do it with your heart and soul, and not think about the fact that there are fewer venues, because you have to believe in the work you're doing and believe that if you produce a compelling story, it will get published. To this day, I still do stories on my own dime, and I still do them and still fight to get them published. I have a story I shot in late October that I'm still trying to get into a magazine. And I think that you just have to have that drive. You have to tell your daughter if she wants to be a photographer, she has to work hard. There's no secret. She has to come up with ideas, research those ideas, get herself there, and produce a story and get it in the hands of people who can put it out there.
There is a world of other people who want to be journalists and tell stories as well. And I think we chatted just before you came on the show about Surya Al-Hura, which means Syria the Free. And this is a new newspaper which is being published in Turkey, but is being distributed in the territories which have now been taken away from the Assad regime. And a guy called Khaled Al-Khatib and a small group of journalists are running this newspaper. And it's great, because they're trying to do something here that is not just propaganda for either side. They're trying to tell some stories which may actually be upsetting to their own side. They're talking about, you know, what actually happens to aid and all these things. We are having a bit of a London-centric conversation in a way, because do you find this, both of you, when you look at this newspaper and you look at places in the emerging world and places where often the most terrifying things are happening, you were in Libya, you suddenly see a flourishing of people wanting to tell stories, wanting to be newspaper men and women. What's your take on that, Lindsay?
I think it's like Pandora's box. I mean, I think if you've lived under a dictatorship for 30 years or your entire life and all of a sudden you're able to have to speak your mind, I think it's invigorating. But at the same time, someone has to be there to teach them the ethics of journalism, you know, because the thing, there's all citizen journalism coming out of Syria, which is very important because most of us can't be there. It's so dangerous that we rely very heavily on these Syrian journalists, but there's no one to check whether things are being made up or posed or what the sort of loyalties are of the journalist or the person filming whatever we're seeing. And so these things have to be taken very seriously because or someone needs to go in there and basically run a school of journalism. I mean, it's very hard.
Can I just ask you, your reference saying that is important there, because we're not getting the stories out of Syria and we're still not getting the images out of Syria that would tell that whole story. For you, what would be the point that you think, do you know what, I'm going to stick my stuff in my backpack, I'm going to cross the border. What point do you feel it's safe or dangerous? Is that something that's just very internal, that's your gut instinct, or do you go to, you know, certain authorities? Are there people you rely on? You know, John's at the Frontline Club. Do you plug into that? How do you gauge for yourself that you know that this is worth, you know, worth putting on your boots, crossing the border for?
A series of things happen. I mean, usually I monitor a story for a while. I see what's going on through reports that are coming out. And then I have a huge network of friends and colleagues who have been in and out. And so I talk to them about what it's like on the ground. That really, really influences whether and when I'm ready to go into a place. And then I decide how much I'm invested in the story. I mean, I have to, if I'm going to go risk my life, I need to care about the people and the story, and I need to believe that I can contribute something as a photographer. So those elements really affect my decision to go in and cross the border.
And John, you know, you have, you know, I wouldn't say parental, but almost that responsibility when you look around a classroom and you see, as you say, you know, young people from 30 countries looking at you, all wanting to make their name, all, you know, young enough to think that they will never get hurt. What kind of tether do you try and put on their ankles before they leave your classroom?
Well, I worry about that a lot. And I think we had a conflict like Libya that allowed many journalists, because of the nature of the geography, to go there without proper training. And Lindsay can speak better than anybody about the difficulties of being in a place like that. But we're in a different country now, in a different conflict, and I really do hope that young journalists don't go off to these places without getting the proper training and taking their lives into their own hands right away. And there is a network, though, of people talking, as Lindsay said. I, at the Frontline Club the other night, a very, very young but very good photojournalist, we were talking about whether or not media should publicize the fact that someone is detained. And he said, you know, that's not a reason it shouldn't be out there, because we're all talking to one another. We already know what's going on.
A slightly different point, I just need to ask you this before we get to the end of the show. If you look through all of the pictures you've taken, is there an image that stands out for you that you think, yeah, all of this has been worth it for that? Or is there a series of images, or is it your canon of work that makes it all worthwhile?
I'm not, no. I mean, I don't have a single image, and there's not, I don't ever sort of look back at the work I've done in the last 15 years and say I'm satisfied. I'm forever tortured and unsatisfied with the work I'm doing, and I pretty much always focus on what I didn't do and what I haven't done. So I think, you know, I hope that the body of work that I've created has educated people and has given them a perspective that has maybe opened their mind or changed their perspective about a place. That's all I can really hope for. And that if someone thought that if someone had preconceived notions about a certain country or women in Afghanistan, I hope that a series of images would have changed those ideas. But that's all I can really hope for. I get emails from around the world from a lot of young women. That, to me, is inspiration enough to keep going, because I know that if those images sort of touch some people or affect them in some way, it helps me go forward. But I'm never sort of satisfied, or I never look back and say...
Can I just ask you, this is a question that I think journalists are increasingly scared to ask themselves or to contemplate, but, you know... Can journalism make the world a bit better? Can we? You know, it's almost been forgotten that thought that actually journalism can change people's opinions and can change people's lives. It sounds to me that you're quite aware of that as you look through the shutter.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't do what I do if I didn't believe that. I mean, why else would I do it? You know, otherwise I'd be a tourist. I mean, I would just travel around the world and stay at 5-star hotels and not stay in a tent and live on protein bars and get shot at. I mean, you know, I have to believe in what I'm doing, and I have to believe that you can still change people's minds.
And John, you know, again, yeah, you must be, you know, there must be lesson after lesson about, you know, the digital age and, you know, contracts and all these things. But again, do you take time for that old-fashioned moment to talk to the class and say, do you know what? You go out of here and do this right, and people's lives can be changed by what you do.
Well, yes, because I think that's the only thing that distinguishes real journalism from the rest of what we call media. I mean, you know, it is still one person or a team witnessing and being present and trying to capture the tales, the stories, the suffering, and translating those into terms that people can understand. And so it's that witnessing that really is what journalism is all about. And yes, the people I want to appear before my class are the people like Lindsay, that's what they believe in. That's why they're doing it. They're not doing it for the big salaries. They're not doing it for celebrityhood. They're doing it because they actually believe being present will perhaps make a difference. It may not in the long run, but that's the goal of journalism. That's what Marie Colvin died for in Homs. That's why she stayed that extra day. Maybe she should never have done so, but she believed that that story would make a difference and some policy response would follow. It hasn't. So you have to be very realistic and accepting that great imaging and great witnessing will not change the world, but there's no reason not to believe it's not worth doing.
Well, I'm not going to add another word to that. That has been an amazing conversation. John Owen and Lindsay Addario, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
And that brings us to the end of the 20th edition of The Stack. And as you heard, my guests today have been John Owen and Lindsay Addario. Our producer was Dawn Trump, and our studio manager was Ben Jay. If you have any comments or queries, then drop us a note at info@monocle.com. And remember, we're back next Saturday at the same time. And of course, you can always listen again via monocle.com or iTunes. So for now, from me, Andrew Tuck, is goodbye and have a good weekend.